If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sarah Jenks Daly, a supervising producer here at Late Night with Seth Meyers. Starting on Friday, the Late Night podcast will release the first episode of a special series devoted to books and authors called Late Night Lit. I half-jokingly pitched that title to our digital team and emphasized that I was half-joking, just in case they hated it, and they said yes. This really is the best place to work. Anyway, over the course of this special series, I'm going to talk to writers, booksellers, and other figures in the literary community about their work, their careers, and what books they love. If you're looking for something new to listen to and read during this era of social distancing, you won't want to miss this series. So please be on the lookout this Friday in the Late Night podcast feed for the first episode of Late Night Lit, in which I interview acclaimed author Colson Whitehead. Until then, happy reading.
Welcome to the Late Night with Seth Meyers podcast. On today's show, you'll hear from two great authors that Seth has interviewed recently, C.Pam Zhang and Sarah Kendzior. First, let's go to his interview with C.Pam Zhang, author of How Much of These Hills is Gold?
Our guest is an author whose debut novel, How Much of These Hills is Gold, is currently available. Please welcome C.Pam Zhang. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Seth. Thank you so much for having me.
So where are you right now?
I'm living in San Francisco right now.
So this, I've talked to some other authors during this time. Obviously, it's really exciting to have a book like yours come out, and usually you would be doing a book tour. You are still managing to pull it off by doing a virtual, I guess I should say virtual events. How has that been?
You know, it's actually been really lovely because I think I, like many authors, don't actually like being in the limelight. So now, you know, only half of my body has to be in the limelight for one, and it sort of gets rid of the one thing that I least like about in-person events, which is the question of, like, where do you look when someone is, like, face down reading out of their book? So it's actually been nice in that way, and I've had friends dial in from places where they ordinarily wouldn't have been able to see me.
Is it true that this is a story that you never intended to be a novel?
Oh, absolutely. So I wrote this, the first chapter of this book, as a short story first, and I really tried as hard as I could to not make it into a novel because it, who wants to write a novel? It just isn't such an arduous and backbreaking task. But it was the situation where I put the story away for a few months and the characters just kept showing up in my head. And at last I was like, well, to get rid of you, to exorcise you in a way, I suppose I just have to write the rest of your story.
I'm always fascinated by writers' processes. Yours is not to write in a specific place or to write at a specific time, but one of the things I've heard about you is that you like to wait almost until the last minute. Like, you like to think about it a lot before you write.
Thinking is a little bit generous. It's probably more subconscious and less like, less thorough than that. But I think that one thing that I've been really interested in the last few years is sort of divesting from this cult of productivity that I think we all live under And, you know, it makes sense if you're working a day job, which I do, but it isn't really a sort of format that applies to art. I think for art, you do kind of have to wait for the inspiration to strike. You have to let all these like feelings sort of simmer and build up inside you.
I imagine that a lot of authors right now feel this burden of, oh my gosh, there's this time that I can use right now to write. Do you feel a little relief that you have to promote writing you've already finished as opposed to, I'm thinking, oh, all these things I wanted to write now that, you know, I'm at home, I should get it done. And of course, it's impossible.
Right. There is definitely that expectation of people. But yeah, I just want to push back on that. I just don't think this is a time. I mean, everyone is sort of in some stage of grief. Everyone is worried. You have so much anxiety. That isn't the place where art is going to come from. So, yeah.
I do find it a very nice time to consume art that someone else has worked on and finished. So it must be nice to have a book out now that people can turn to in these times. This is a book about Asian American immigrants. You know, obviously, you know, in general, over the last few years, I feel as though we've been talking about and reconsidering exactly the plight of what immigrants go through in this country. Do you feel like your book came out at an opportune time in that people's minds are open to sort of understanding what life immigrants in this country live?
Mm-hmm. You know, what's really interesting is I started writing this book in early 2015. So this was not only before coronavirus, but also before the 2016 elections. And I remember finishing this book and wondering, like, is it too maudlin? Is it too histrionic in its depiction of racism and naked racism against Asian people? And yeah, now we're living in this time. And it is sadly more relevant than ever. But I guess it sort of like goes along with this lifelong obsession I've really had. You know, I came here as an immigrant and my parents were immigrants. And it really took me 20 some years to sort of realize that we are living with this myth of the American dream. And it really, really, truly is a myth. This idea that anyone who works hard enough can have success in this country. And it's just not true because there are so many systemic barriers in place. And, you know, I think that's always been the sort of unfairness of that has been always been more visible to immigrants and to people of color. But I think we're all seeing it now with the sort of like failures of the country's response to the epidemic and how many people's lives are very fragile right now.
You also, you know, this book takes place in the American West, excuse me. Obviously that seems to be a part of the country that you have a connection to. When did you first find your way out west?
My family moved from Kentucky, which was the first place that we lived in America, out to California when I was about 8. So that whole journey, we took it in a car over several days, really made an impression on me. There's something just really beautiful and epic about this part of the world.
And I think that's really one of the lovely things about the book is both it's very honest about parts of the American myth that aren't real, but also it is a very sort of loving, beautiful book about this country. And it must be nice in the writing, balancing both of those in order to tell a story.
Yeah, I do hope that love comes through. I think it's interesting. You can have this deep connection and affection for a country, even as it is difficult to live here sometimes.
I want to finish because one thing that, you know, I certainly keep reading about is how independent bookstores are having a hard time, you know, when their doors are closed and people can't come in. And I think that is a location more than ever that people go actually like to walk in and peruse and find books. Are there any ways, any independent bookstores you'd like to shout out now if people want to get your book?
Yes, absolutely. Some of my favorites in San Francisco are Green Apple Books, Booksmith, and Dog-Eared Books, and they're all really wonderful places where I think you can order online or just call them in some cases and have them shipped to you.
That's excellent. Hey, thank you so much. Congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for making time with us today.
Thank you, Seth. Bye.
Bye.
Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug, ignored a leaky faucet, pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects, but there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone, and in just a few steps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next, because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
Now let's hear Seth's interview with Sarah Kendzior, author of the new book, Hiding in Plain Sight.
Our next guest is a New York Times bestselling author. Her new book, Hiding in Plain Sight, is available now. Please welcome back to the show, Sarah Kendzior. How are you, Sarah?
As well as can be expected. How are you?
I'm good. I like that in your bookshelf behind you, you're using it to very smartly promote your new book.
Oh, yes. Of course.
Well, we were talking, you obviously had a book tour planned. You were actually going to be on our show in the studio back in, I guess, in March. So how has it been having a new book out that obviously you've worked on for years and not being able to go out and promote it?
I mean, I'm sad about it. I'm sad that I didn't get to, you know, see my readers face to face, but I'm mostly thinking about safety and I wouldn't want to put anyone in that position. And there are certainly people who are having a much harder time in this economy and in this public health crisis than me. The book itself is about the danger of this administration and the erosion of stable institutions, not just in the present, but over the last 40 years. So paradoxically, this is a good time for the book to come out.
So I want to talk about the book, but real quick, you recently tweeted the last time you were on the show, and again, it was nice that you got to see the other guests. Mm-hmm. You were backstage, you got to meet Ice-T, and here is the photo that you tweeted. And is it true that your mother has this frame?
Oh, yeah. I gave it to her as a Mother's Day gift because I sent it to her and she loved it. And then, you know, I surprised her. So she has it on her mantle, just like every baby boomer, huge Ice-T fan, Law and Order, completely forgot that she confiscated my Body Count cassette in like 1991. So, you know.
Well, it's a shame because, you know, the first guest tonight was Ice Cube. So I like that there's something thematic about the times on your show.
As long as this doesn't lead to Vanilla Ice the third time around, then I'm all good with this trend. So
last time you were on, you were talking about your book, View from a Flyover Country. And it was a lot about sort of you had studied autocratic regimes and how they, you know, have this way of sneaking up on people, exactly what is happening to the, you know, systems they rely on. You obviously wrote this book. You couldn't imagine the moment we were in right now, but it does sort of predict that if things don't change, this is the sort of thing we were going to end up with, right?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't predict that I would be talking to you during a plague from our self-quarantine, but in terms of malice, in terms of kleptocracy, in terms of the profound erosion of institutional stability and social trust, this is what I expected from the Trump administration, because we've had this kind of facetious, unearned, reliance on checks and balances that were never really there. They were not applied at the start of his administration, and he has spent the last 4 years annihilating them, purging agencies, packing courts, basically stripping this country down and selling it for parts. And so, yeah, here we are.
Well, you point out that the media sometimes will focus on Trump's ineptitude, but you think the mistake there is it ignores the more sinister side of it.
Yes, absolutely. I think that the media, as well as many people, are just comfortable thinking of him as a buffoon that stumbled into the presidency, like it was an accident. But that's not true. And as I lay out in the book, he ran or nearly ran for president five times, 1988, 1996, he ran in 2000, he ran in 2012, he ran in 2016. And one of his enduring strategies has been to cover up his crime with scandal and to cover up his malice with incompetence. A lot of people are shocked by his reaction to the pandemic, that we haven't had a national mourning, that the flag hasn't even been lowered to commemorate the victims and the people who tried to save them. But that's completely in line with his character. When 9/11 happened, his first reaction was to say it made his buildings look taller. When the 2008 financial collapse happened, he said that it was a good thing for him, that he would profit. And back in 2014, he went on Fox News and said that he wanted economic collapse and he wanted riots and violence in the street, because that's what makes America great again.
you don't hold back in your book as far as like naming names. And I think a way a lot of times some journalists not only fear, you know, the shutting down of access for projects they might do in the future, but also, you know, for personal safety. When you are specific about people, do you ever fear for your safety when you write?
I mean, of course I fear for my safety. And we've seen a lot of examples of this administration and people connected to it threatening people. You know, we just had an impeachment hearing where the ambassador to Ukraine basically said that Trump and his goon squad ordered a hit on her. That's a huge deal. And there's a long history of that kind of action. I worry about my safety, but I'm more worried that the truth of this administration and its history isn't being told. And so that's what, you know, I have chosen to do in this book and through my other work. And I don't care about access. You know, I live in Missouri. I'm not worried about not being invited to a cocktail party or, you know, whatever the hell people do in DC. And so that's never really been an issue for me. And, you know, perversely, it gives me a certain kind of freedom.
You talk a lot, not just in the book, but also on your podcast about the elections in November. How much confidence do you think the American people can have in a fair election right now? And I do think, you know, sometimes when you talk about it, it's a little dangerous because obviously the Trump administration, based on the outcome, will also speak to the idea that it was not fair. So how do you frame it so that it just doesn't become a thing that everyone can sort of use for their own best interests?
Yeah, I mean, everyone is going to claim that it's rigged. That was a little trick they pulled in 2016 by, you know, Trump constantly saying it was rigged. It forced the Democrats into this position where they're like, it can't be rigged. And then when it was in some respects rigged, they had nothing to say. What they should be doing is pushing for election transparency and integrity early. They should be pushing for vote by mail because of the coronavirus, because of the dangers we are being put in by having physical voting. I've been worried about the integrity of this election for a long time before the virus came around. I've been worried about domestic voter suppression, foreign interference, insecure machines, and Trump simply refusing to leave. My new worry is that perhaps the election will be delayed or kind of indefinitely postponed. Usually, even autocrats love elections. You know, they like to have a fake election so that they could brag about the people's love. And I didn't think that Trump would turn down an opportunity to do that. But given this unprecedented public health crisis, it's uncertain what direction they'll go.
Don't take this the wrong way. There is a core pessimism to a lot of what you write about. But do you feel as though there might be a chance to come through this on the other side with a changed perspective from the American people? And where do you find optimism?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think about it so much in terms of optimism or pessimism or hope or hopelessness. I just try to do the right thing. You know, when you have so much chaos, when you have so much instability, you really have to look at your morals and your principles and how you treat people and the kind of life that you want to lead. And so I just try to do the right thing. I do try to make suggestions that are helpful in that respect. But I'm not going to have blind faith in eroding institutions that we've already seen fail. You know, what Americans, I think, have recognized by now, that institutions are only as good as the people who are willing to uphold them. And sometimes they have to uphold those institutions in the face of profound and unprecedented threats. And so far, that has not really happened. That doesn't mean it's too late. It doesn't mean that we're doomed. It does mean we're in for a rough ride and that we really have to get our bearings and focus always on telling the truth and treating people right.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for making time for us again. Obviously, I wish this would be in the studio, and hopefully next time it'll be in person. Please check out Sarah's new book, Hiding in Plain Sight. We got a couple copies for you. And thanks, Sarah.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.